Oh, I forgot to mention Coffee Island. Damn.
What it is it good for?
Because, like,
yeah. You can do it, yeah.
Maybe it could be part of the outro, I guess. I don't know. They don't sponsor us, but why not?
Like, yeah, yeah.
They are literally coursing through our veins at all times.
Yeah, except
like,
my
we
veins.
We would not exist
it's gonna be like,
without
wow,
Coffee
yeah.
Island. It's really good. This one is an Ethiopia blend, Guji. It's very nice.
I don't drink coffee, but out. If they sponsor us, I will start drinking coffee. Yes.
Well, they also sell sugar. So, you know, you can get fair trade sugar from Coffee Island. Yes. That will just be perfect for you. Back to Fractured. We have a very special episode this week. This is season 3, episode 15. We have really going crazy. Every 2 weeks, we hold our word. We have a very special guest today. It's Katie Fallon, who's a freelance journalist, works on migration and social affairs, and she has a laundry list of organizations that she has written for. It's Al Jazeera, The Wire, The Guardian, Telegraph. You're just constantly in print, and it's amazing to have you with us.
Wow.
And as always, it's a special episode as well because Rashid has forced me into the center chair today.
Yes, he's forced.
So he wants to be the co-host on the side. He remembers his old days back on the side. So, but if you're new to the podcast, Fractured is an original production of Refocus Media Labs. We're here in our Athens lab. And the program has been centered around citizen journalism to provide members of our community an opportunity to talk about issues that face refugees and talk about migration and go take a deep dive into the issues. So today having Katie with us is a really wonderful pleasure. We've had you on the show in the past, but only in the radio form. First time we have you here in living color on camera. Very cool. And
is it first time we do episode about the UK?
No, we did several really? In the past. We did two last season. Year. Well, actually, one each year we've done. Actually, almost a year ago, we did our last Refugees Not Welcome, where we had you on the show.
Yes,
but it was just radio only.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Almost exactly a year ago to the day.
Wow. Great to be back in
anniversary.
The flesh. Yeah.
It's good. You're a regular now.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Rashid, anything you want to say to start the show?
No, welcome everybody, and let's go to the UK this time.
Okay, let's go.
So, we know you very well from the work on Lesbos in Greece, and you're based here in Athens, and you've been doing a tremendous amount of reporting, as we said, for tons of papers and you know, outlets, and it's centered a lot around what goes on here in the Mediterranean. But you are British. And
unfortunately, yes, for better for worse.
And you have
luckily,
and you also have been doing a lot of reporting back there as well. And prior to coming here, we read a couple of pieces that you did for the New Humanitarian, and one of them, you kind of took us to this place of like your almost like your origin story, like your Batman story, like how did you end up doing migration and it centered around like your childhood and a little bit about the early days of how you eventually become this really amazing migration reporter and journalist. So could you take us back to those days in Calais? And
Sure. Well, thank you so much for that very nice introduction. It's really great to be here with you guys again. Sure. So, I mean, I'm from London, but my grandparents lived in Canterbury and Dover. And Dover is the kind of main town hub. It's a huge port city opposite Calais, which is where there are continue to be kind of informal camps where asylum seekers, people who are hoping to make it to the UK are living. So for me, I spent a lot of my childhood on the beaches that people kind of invariably reach when they take these small boats to the UK. So they end up in Dover or Folkestone or sort of around that area, around the south coast. Dover is, I mean, okay, it's like Lesbos in the way, and it's a city that a place that watches another country that is sort of defined by shipping, by trade, by migration as well, in the sense of, you know, there's ferries, I don't know if hundreds, but many every day crossing the channel, taking people back and forth. I think it's one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. And yeah, it was where I spent some of my summers with my grandmother, sat on the beach. It's got these pebbled beaches, having ice creams, walking along the promenade. Dover was for me, yeah, it's just something I associate with my family. It's a bit of a down on its luck city in some ways. It's got some investment recently, but it's an old industrial kind of city. It's a wonderful place. It's also historically very important. It's where it has these huge kind of white cliffs, which have got a bit dirty in recent years due to pollution, but there's stories of soldiers returning in the Second World War and seeing these white cliffs and crying because they saw home suddenly. And it was where in the Second World War they dug deep tunnels into the cliffs, and they had kind of medical facilities and operation rooms and stuff. So anyway, Dover has sort of a big history. It's always been this kind of point of transit. It's always been important, let's say.
But now you're in your piece with the New Humanitarian, you talked a little bit about how you look at that channel very differently.
Yeah, I think it's strange seeing, and it kind of reminds me of what people have told me at times on Lesbos, this idea of this place that you grow up and you have these associations with, positive associations, right? I have very positive associations growing up there, and childhood memories, you know, scooting down the promenade on my little scooter. And it's kind of really strange now. My great aunt and uncle, sadly my great uncle's passed, but my great aunt has a flat that looks directly right over the water, and you can see France from there. It's kind of that close in some ways. It's similar to Lesbos again, like that. But
how close is it?
It's a few. I'm not going to say on record because
but you can see it.
It's anywhere between a few miles and 10 or 20. I honestly can't remember. Mm-hmm. I'd need to double check. But you can see it. Yeah, you can see France. So it's always strange looking out on that water and kind of thinking of, the people that are trying to reach this side, and also the kind of tragedies that have taken place there, you know, the deaths, and it is a very, very dangerous piece of water, you know. I think you don't realize that, especially when you're younger and you're just playing in the sea, but I mean, it's, you would never go out there in a boat. I mean, it's very, very risky, and it's very deep and very busy. You have ships crossing that all the time. So, yeah, I do see it very differently now. It's kind of a complicated view when you look across the water. It's not just this place of happy memories. It still is, but it's a place where I always think of, yeah, the people on the other side.
And, like, the channel's in the news all the time, and we're obviously going to talk a lot about the small boats and what's going on a regular basis. But you also did a lot of work in Calais, in the jungle, on the other side. And that seemed to be kind of like a seminal moment for you as a journalist. Also, like, what is it looking like right now as to why people would be taking that risk to cross this really dangerous strait?
So when I first went there was this place called informally the jungle, which was a kind of shanty town type structure with, I think there was 10,000 people at one point living there, that was bulldozed completely, I think, at the end of 2016. I might have my dates wrong, but anyway, it was bulldozed completely. So this place where many different communities had been living, and they had some informal restaurants set up, places you could buy tea, there was charities operating there. But since it was bulldozed, there's been less of a, it wasn't a great place to live then, but it was the place to live. And now, since then, it's become increasingly hostile. I mean, we talk about the hostile environment, and that kind of translates to different things. But in Calais that kind of has meant an increased police presence. People, you know, will be sleeping in tents or sleeping bags, and I've heard stories of, you know, they'll have their tents slashed, or their sleeping bags tear gassed, or like sort of random acts of cruelty, like taking one of someone's one shoe out of a pair or something. And people are sort of moved on. They'll have all their stuff confiscated at various points, and they can often not get it back. And so, yeah, it's a very difficult place to be living. I mean, this was quite a few years ago now, but, you know, there were some young boys I met sleeping in a quarry. It was all kind of very, very tense as well, because the police were continually moving people on, continually detaining people. There was harassment of volunteers, people working there in some of the organizations. So yeah, and Calais is, I don't know, the city is quite also down on its luck in lots of ways. It's quite, it's not like a sort of beautiful place to live either. So it's quite dreary, and I don't know, some people who live there might challenge me for that, but that was my experience. And it's a place people pass through when they arrive, but if you are arriving there from the UK on the ferry, but you then leave. But for the people living there, yeah, it's become increasingly hostile, increasingly difficult, and large amounts of money are put into, including from the UK, and it put into sort of patrols to ensure people are kind of, that people can't live there in any sense of the word, you know. And this pushes people further to want to go to the UK, because understandably, when you've been made to feel unwelcome in most of the places you've passed through on the way, why would you want to stay? And I mean, people have a myriad of different reasons. Many have family, many speak English. Some young boys I met told me that they grew up listening to the BBC World Service, so they had this kind of vision of the UK through that. And yeah, many people come from countries where the UK was the colonizing power, you know? And so they have this idea that, well, you were there in my country, why can't I come to yours, you know? And also we have these links now because of it. So, but it's utterly bleak. It's just, you know, and also it's cold, right? It's Northern Europe, it's wet, windy, the winters are difficult, the summers aren't necessarily that much easier for different reasons. But yeah, all of this contributes to a place where it feels intolerable to live. And, you know, just visiting there, to do some of my reporting, you know, you feel it. You feel anxious as well, because of the fact that the police are always out kind of, you know, watching, and there's always this sense of kind of continuing low-level intimidation that goes on.
All right, let's go to the actual nightmare, the Rwanda deal.
Oh my God.
So, a lot of flaws. It's not even humane, and it's costing a lot of money. According to the National Audit Office, UK paid £240 million, and is going to pay more in the next 5 years. All Sunak's efforts to make it have failed. Why he's still just holding to this deal? Like, why?
I mean, I think you have to view it in the context of performance, like this theater politics that we've got into, especially with not just the Conservative Party, but many right and far right parties across Europe, playing into populist kind of visions of what they think should be solutions to what perceived crises such as migration. The Rwanda deal, I mean, no one quite knows why Rishi Sunak and his party keep sticking to it. I think because they've kind of nailed themselves to this policy now, it's almost inextricable with them. So if they were to admit that it's a failure, complete waste of time, a huge waste of money, it would just contribute to this sense that they are completely ineffective. And I mean, opinion polls suggest that they aren't going to win the next election anyway. And the small boats has been a big kind of talking point for Rishi Sunak. It's been an effective, many people argue, an effective distraction from other things happening in the UK, and a way of turning people away from sort of some of the bigger issues and blaming other people, which Rwanda is part of this bigger narrative of shifting the blame onto migrants, asylum seekers, refugees, rather than taking responsibility for government policies which have directly impacted people's lives. So Rwanda, the reason they keep pursuing it is it makes headlines. You know, it's an effective way of appearing to be doing something without really doing anything. I mean, it would only ever accommodate a sort of, I think, around 100 or just over 100 people at a time anyway. So it would never be a solution to housing people, to processing. None of it would be a sustainable solution.
But he's selling it as it's, he said it's going to save us billions of pounds. Like what? Housing there, 300 people is going to save you billions.
Politicians don't always tell the truth.
Yeah, and people listening to it and voting for him.
But this sounds like it's just like a legal embarrassment. I mean, the EU Court of Human Rights said it was unlawful. Then eventually even the Supreme Court of England it says it's unlawful, the equivalent of in the US saying it's unconstitutional, or that like it's just been challenged upon challenge to legally to delay it. It's been going on for years. But now in the most recent iteration, there have been, I mean, the main reason why they said that it was illegal and unlawful was that it didn't really protect the people who would be put there.
Yeah.
And that they couldn't justify, they couldn't really monitor the asylum procedure in Rwanda to clarify that it would be safe for them. They couldn't confirm that there would not be refoulement sent back to other countries or their home countries. So there were a lot of reasons in international law that this whole concept, I remember when it first came about, it was like, they're going to do what? Like, this sounds insane. Yeah. But now there's a new version of this bill. And could you give us a little bit of an update of where do we stand right now?
Well, they're attempting, if this is what you're talking about, they're attempting to pass through legislation which would confirm that Rwanda is a safe country, which has been met with, not everyone agrees with this policy, right? I mean, it's also not indicative of a general public opinion or anything. And there's many politicians, including in the House of Lords, which is where legislation is sent to be checked, and it has to pass through the House of Lords in order for it to become law. So there is pushback, particularly from the House of Lords. I don't know exactly where it is, and there's a kind of in the process, but they're attempting to designate Rwanda as a safe country, which would then for them solve some issues, apparently, although I imagine there would be further challenges legally to that. And it just seems like a way of kicking the can down the road, essentially, to deal with it at a later date. I mean, I don't know. Perhaps I imagine something. I know that Sunak has said he wants to get it done in the next few months. We have to have an election by the end of the year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the clock is ticking. If you asked me personally, I don't think anyone will be sent by the end of the year. I severely doubt it. In all likelihood, we'll have a new government by the end of the year, and they do not support the Rwanda plan as it is.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch, we've been kind of going down the deep rabbit hole of UK politics for the couple of weeks to be ready for this episode. And I mean, the House of Lords right now, Sunak and then Starmer's, it looks like some sort of weird cross between like a bad stand-up routine slash ineffectual rap battle. Like, it's like, it's really, really, it's like what you would show to say in your workshops for a stand-up, to say, don't do this.
Okay, right? Yeah.
Because, like, everything is just this back and forth, no substance, zingers, trying to, it's like a waste of everyone's time and effort, but this is what's on the media every day. And
yeah. I mean, unfortunately, that's not just about this, that's British politics, particularly recently. I mean, yeah, I think many people have commented on the quality of debate and the way it's become quite populist in some ways. It's I don't know what will happen, but certainly it's very strange to see how it's debated in Parliament. And I don't think any of it is done at a very serious level.
But like with Labour and Starmer's in particular, like basically being labelled the open border side of the argument, and
yeah,
that they're, which is not what they're actually advocating for either. But it would be really interesting to see if the polls are accurate and conservative, the Tories fall out of power finally, what will Labour do with the same problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the kind of million-dollar question, so to speak, because Labour haven't really put forward sort of many big initiatives suggesting, I mean, they've said that they don't believe in the Rwanda deal or whatever, but in general, and this isn't just in the area of immigration, they've been quite quiet, they've been quite kind of careful, perhaps, in what they're saying. They haven't put forward any grand plans. So, I mean, some people I know from the left are kind of, I think, concerned about what Labour's plan might be, because they haven't made as big noises about things as some people would like. And so they don't really support the Rwanda deal, so I imagine that would fold if Labour came into power, but it's kind of uncertain what they will do exactly, because they haven't been, I think, as much as some people would like, you know, from the sort of left campaigning perspective, as kind of strong against some of these policies as some people would like. And whether it's just because they're being very careful before an election, because they're aware of how the media twists things very easily, particularly the right-wing press, I don't know. But yeah, it kind of remains to be seen what will happen if Labour comes into power. For sure, it will not be this, and it will be less extreme. But I can't say for sure that it will be a kind of idealist utopia. I mean, it certainly won't be an idealist utopia under Labour either. They're occupying more of a centrist ground, and they have some kind of more right policies as well.
I have a friend from Rwanda. He lives in France now, and he applied for asylum, and they rejected him. And his whole family were killed in Rwanda because of the conflict there. And then he said, now my next step is to go to the UK. Like, he will go to the UK, he will get deported to Rwanda. What about the Rwandan refugees? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense, this deal.
Well, actually, that would be interesting, because he wouldn't be legally allowed to be sent back to Rwanda, because that would be safe country.
Yeah,
for
you
him.
See how.
So they would claim that Rwanda's a safe country for anyone who's illegally arrived in the UK. But, oh, clearly it's not safe for him. That would be really an interesting case study to see what would happen if he did.
So, The Independent published some numbers. This year, more than 5,400 boats arrived to the UK. 43% increase from the same period last year. Rishi Sunak pledged to stop the boats. How exactly he's going to do that? Is it going to be involved the Frontex? My fear is that it's going to, at some point, they're going to have another Pylos shipwreck, because they're going to start pushing around and killing people there.
I don't know. Stop the boats is just a very helpful slogan that has been used as well in Australia as well. I think there's been parallels drawn between the Australian policy as well as the Greek one. I don't think it's incorrect to fear that more lives will be lost. I mean, we will never have such huge boats as we saw in the Adriana, the Pylos shipwreck, because it's just a different sort of situation. So that doesn't mean that any lives lost is avoidable and tragic. But I don't think there's a grand plan to stop the boats. I think if you asked Rishi Sunak, he would tell you XYZ, they're sending money to France, the French are doing further patrols, that they have all these sorts of deterrents. But ultimately, I mean, as we've seen, the only person that profits from like border deterrents are smugglers. And there was a great piece in The Guardian done by a great journalist, published a couple of years ago now, but it was about Calais and the smugglers. Basically, she spoke to some smugglers and they were saying, basically, like, the stronger border policies are good for us, you know, we profit from them. So, I mean, they've done what they can to stop people getting onto lorries, because that was what people did before they took the boats. They got onto lorries because there's a tunnel that connects the UK and France, the Channel Tunnel, and it has lorries going in and passenger cars, and people would climb either into lorries or underneath them. And people did die trying to get onto lorries, but now they've, if you go there, you can see they built the fences to enter into the tunnel, like, so high. And so much barbed wire, and there's so many checks. It's very difficult to do that now. So that's why people are taking the boats. And in terms of stopping the boats, the UK has done a deal recently with Frontex.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was in February. The new executive director went to the UK and they signed an agreement, as I understand. So there is going to be further cooperation, but I know there were suggestions to kind of imitate what the Greeks are doing in terms of pushbacks or pullbacks or whatever, but that was deemed a debate in a special select committee in Parliament. It was discussed and it was, you know, thankfully acknowledged to be far too dangerous to do any of those sorts of things. But there was a report recently, I think, by Lighthouse Reports, which showed a video of a French Coast Guard boat kind of doing dangerous maneuvers around a dinghy in the channel, very similar to videos we've seen of what the Greek Coast Guard does. So, these are the sorts of things I imagine will be kind of highlighted as these stopping the boats. But the boats aren't stopping, as we see. They're just, people keep coming, and I imagine that they're paying even more for their crossing because it's becoming more difficult.
And we saw the same things. I mean, it does feel as if the UK is copying and pasting the Greek administration here in terms
the
of
worst
what they've
example.
Been doing. Like, but like saying, oh, we'll deem the countries safe to clarify that these people are not allowed to come, therefore by coming, they are automatically considered illegal.
Yeah.
And therefore they can hold them. And we can talk a little bit more later in the second half about what does that really look like in detention centers. But the policies are really similar, eerily similar. The behaviors, the denial of the maneuvers on the sea.
Yeah.
It just feels like there is no political repercussion for these types of breaches of international law. RSA Aegean recently challenged, along with, the Greek policy of Turkey being a safe country, basically stating that it's supposed to be determined on an individual level, not on a countrywide situation. So everything about it is just wrong, but there isn't a political consequence.
No, and it's worth mentioning that we've had two British Home Secretaries, who are the kind of interior ministers, visit the island of Samos and go out on patrols with coast guards and go to visit the camp there. So.
Research.
I guess. So, I mean, that speaks for itself, I guess.
So with the amount of time we have left in this session, we wanted to let everyone know that in the break in between our episodes, we always try to profile an organization or a workflow or an artist that's doing amazing things. And so today we're going to get a chance to listen to some music by some amazing DJs that work with an organization in the UK called Pollination UK. And we're doing a collaboration with them along with Safe Passage UK, which is an organization that supports people who are crossing and then need legal and humanitarian supports once they're in the UK. And the imagery that you're going to see is going to be done by our graphic design team here. So enjoy the show, and we'll be back shortly. Welcome back from the break. We hope you enjoyed the music and the designs, and we're really excited about furthering the relationship between Refocus, Pollination UK, Safe Passage, and some new beats and some new albums and new work is coming out. And very soon in mid-June in London, we're going to have a nice, really big arts festival. So we'll keep you posted on that. But in the meantime, let's get back into this wonderful conversation with Katie Fallon and with Rashid Ghali. I'm Douglas Herman. I'm one of the co-founders of Refocus Media Labs, and I'm sitting in today for Sonia Nanjik Herman, my wife and co-host of the show. She's up in Poland finishing up an exhibition with IRC, so you have me today. But back to Katie. And the horror show of UK politics when it comes to a refugee crisis that feels politically manipulated and manufactured. When we look at the numbers of the number of people who are actually coming into the country legally, which these figures don't really show up in the net migration figures of how many people come to the UK every year, a totally different category. it's a pretty small number. Yet, if you were paying attention to the media, you would think it's like, I don't know, millions of people every day of the week coming into the country. And yet, the second half of this episode, we kind of wanted to talk about what is life like if you did make it to the UK, you did survive the Channel crossing, and now you're in what is your life like in the UK in the process of trying to stay or potentially being someone who would be sent to Rwanda if this policy is enacted and put into play. But what is life like for an asylum seeker in the UK? And in terms of the detention centers or the spaces where people are kept, what could you inform our viewers about this general experience?
Sure. Okay. So you don't have a right to work if you're an asylum seeker. This has been a thing of contention, and it's people have tried to change it, but it still remains the case that you can't work. You get very limited allowance every month. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's very, very low. You're accommodated in, it depends what your situation or circumstance is. There's different accommodations. People have been put up in hotels, in former military bases. Some have been put on the Bibby Stockholm, this kind of floating barge, which was criticized by many rights groups and charities and people in the local area as well, in Dorset, where it's currently is. And I mean, like many places, it's a kind of process of waiting. If your asylum is being processed, and obviously there has been varying degrees of success in processing asylum claims. They're taking quite long, as I understand. And I mean, I think this was always what people were asking. I think people are always very shocked when they arrive in the UK about what life is like as an asylum seeker, because it's not this kind of land of human rights and an amazing standard of living if you are in that situation. And I think it's very disheartening for people when they've traveled so far and been through so much and they arrive and they're in the situation. Often they're, the levels of accommodation not great. I mean, the Bibby Stockholm, which is this kind of big barge that was used in the Netherlands until it was shut down, is now still accommodating asylum seekers, but it's had numerous horrible instances, such as Legionella's disease was initially found on the boat and people had to be temporarily moved off. A guy who was put on there committed suicide, reportedly. That seems to be what happened. He was from Albania. So it can be very isolating. And the UK has this hostile environment. I mean, it was a policy specifically created under Theresa May, I think, former Prime Minister when she was Home Secretary, termed it the hostile environment. I might be wrong on sort of attributing it to her as the creator, but anyway, it definitely things got worse since then. The idea is to make it as difficult a place to live. And then obviously we have detention centres, which is where you're put if you have an issue with your immigration status. We have, I think we're the only place in Europe where we have an unlimited amount of time you can be put in detention unless you're pregnant. You have Jarl's Wood, which I think is just for female detainees. But I mean, there's always been awful stories coming out of these places. There's various different security companies which are contracted out to run them. And there's been various allegations over the years of human rights abuses happening. We've had people separate to the detention centres, as I mentioned, accommodated in camps, former military barracks, which sort of rings similar to some of the stuff happening in Greece again. And again, the conditions there aren't amazing. So it's difficult. And I think that was always something that people would say, especially when you met them in Calais, like, I can't wait to go, you know, what's it like, you know, the UK, it's this great place, you know, because they've had so many bad experiences along the way. They've been beaten up by so many different security services in every different country that they have this vision. And I would feel the same of like, I can't wait to get to that place across the water. I can see it and it's going to be amazing. And life isn't amazing, unfortunately. And particularly being denied the right to work whilst you're seeking asylum feels very kind of manifestly cruel. And so, yeah, it's difficult. It's a difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, there's like this laundry list of these places and that have these horror show experiences that people have gone through in these investigative reports. And one that stood out to me that was really terrible was Brookhouse, where someone, BBC Panorama and The Independent, were doing these investigative researches. There were some whistleblowers in the space. And this is a couple of years ago, but it was caught on camera, people doing these types of like really, really aggressive physical behavior towards people.
Yeah.
In one instance, some guy was choking someone, screaming at him, and I quote, "You fucking piece of shit, I'm going to put you to fucking sleep." And then another one is mocking Drago, the big Russian boxer from Rocky IV, and looking at someone who's injured and is in need of medical care, and he says, "If he dies, he dies." And this is like, you know, years ago. It's continued. There are instances like this all the time. And the companies that were once there, this G4S that was in charge of these spaces, they're like, oh, well, they're gone now, so we don't have to worry about this. But then they put in a company like Serco, and they are guilty of it as well in multiple spaces. And they just signed new 8-year deals this year.
Yeah.
It's kind of insane.
Yeah. I mean, I always struggle to recall specific reports because they're just, like you said, so many. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of difficult to know what to say about that because this has just been going. I mean, the whole detention issue, particularly the detention centres, is such a big issue. It obviously, detaining people indefinitely is a huge cost as well. So it always seems quite strange as to why you would do that. It seems, again, to be a sort of a way of deterrence. Obviously, some people would argue there's security concerns, but for most of these people who are in these detention centres, it just seems to be like genuinely horror stories about their experiences and have committed no offence apart from not having the right passport or the right papers or whatever. But yeah, these reports have been going on for years, and it's just a round table of different security companies which then take over or whatever, and it's all the same thing with a different label on it.
You mentioned the BB Stockholm, such a cute name for prison. Living conditions are bad. Asylum seekers spoke to The Guardian about the concerns of the security on board. They have to go through airport-style security and body search, even when they go out for smoke. Quality of food is really bad, and more than 65 organizations called for closure of this vessel. So any updates?
I mean, I think the only update is that it's still going. So, yeah, it's still hosting people, and there was obviously people in the local area weren't happy about it either for many different reasons, because they also thought it was wrong, right? I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that many people in the UK don't support these policies, don't agree with this tactic, the way of treating people when they arrive in our country, and I wouldn't say that it's kind of representative of a general level of cruelty that's just part of the UK population. It's not. And the Bibby Stockholm was kind of presented as this solution to costly ways of accommodating people because they'd been accommodated in hotels. But it's doesn't seem to be, I mean, it's still functioning, it's still floating, it's still got people on board. I don't know what will happen to it.
Is it moving or is it
no, it's stationary. Stationary, okay. Stationary, mm. Yeah, it's stationary. I believe it was shut down when it was used before because there was allegations of rights abuses happening. I can't remember, all the conditions were so bad. I can't remember, but I know that it was used and then in the Netherlands, I think.
Yeah, but then they have other boats in use now. We actually have some colleagues that are running programming, right, similar to Refocus that are on these barges.
Right.
Or okay, these ferries, like a big, like giant ships that you would take for a carnival cruise or something.
Sure.
So they just came up with another version.
Yeah. Right. So the only update with the Bibby Stockholm is it continues to exist. Yeah.
But in these detention spaces, it's kind of shocking to me that you said, you know, that the UK is the only European country that does not have a maximum limit of like detention, and other than I think it's 72 hours if you're a pregnant woman. But if you just like compare that to regular law inside UK society, if you are suspected of a crime, a police can detain you, they can arrest you, and they can hold you for 24 hours without charge, and then they would have to release you if they couldn't charge you with something. If you are suspected of a significantly violent crime, they could get a court order to hold you for up to 48 hours and then would have to charge you, or they'd have to let you back into society, probably even knowing that you are a high risk of more violent behavior, either murder, rape, these other types of like really intense things. But you would be released back into society, a true danger, because they didn't have enough evidence to hold you. And yet, if you just arrive on a boat, they can hold you indefinitely. And it's like insanity in my mind, legally, that that could be the reality. But I know that there are organizations that are fighting for there to be detention as a last resort and 28-day maximum stays. And I don't know if you have any information about success in that range, in terms of like that on those campaigns,
to
get that to be 28 only?
I don't. I know that it's been like a long running campaign for a long time, obviously. Again, I don't know if things will change under Labour. I don't know, but I mean, there's so many issues currently. Unfortunately, this kind of doesn't quite even reach the radar of many people. It's worth noting that Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, is a human rights lawyer by trade. So, but again, some people would argue that we haven't quite seen that in some of the policies he's putting out. But I don't know what will happen, because we're talking at the end of the Conservatives have been in power all my adult life, basically since I was 18. So it's been quite a long time now, and we're at the tail end of one era I think is ending, maybe. So I don't know, but in terms of the progress of those campaigns, I'm not sure. I could be wrong, and I'd be happy if I am wrong, if any progress has been made, but I don't know if anything sort of tangibly has happened to kind of challenge that effectively.
So the Home Office latest measures announced in September 2023, they will allow the use of scientific age assessment method to estimate the age of children arriving in the UK. Many leading medicals and professional bodies have raised ethical concerns, saying it's too dangerous because it's gonna have some radiation exposure, not ethical, harmful, and also if you say no to it, you'll be considered over 18. Just if you said, no, I don't want to do this. So what the hell is going on?
Well, I mean, this is another kind of policy which who knows how long it will stay. The Home Office seems to be a kind of one of those kind of bingo machines that you keep pressing and like different kind of crazy combinations happen every time you press a button. And that's not to say, like, I should say also that the Home Office is full of civil servants as well, people who I know don't always agree with some of the policies they're having to work on or whatever. So that, like, it's not to say that the Home Office is in itself manifestly evil, but obviously the people at the head of it have got some very strange and cruel kind of visions of how to deal with asylum claims and things like age assessments. Again, this is a big thing which speaks to the nature of our media culture in the UK. So we have some very powerful right-wing papers, such as the Daily Mail, particularly. But there's also papers like The Sun, which made a big deal about people arriving pretending to be minors, teenagers, who they said were adults. And a few years ago, they did this really cruel thing where they posted the faces of some of these people who were claiming to be children or who were children and saying these can't be children because they've got beards or they've got, facial hair. Or it's mainly men they target. This is, again, not a UK-specific thing, but there's this big artificial whipped-up fear of young single men, and this is where the age assessment thing comes into play, because they say, well, we're going to root out the people who are adults from the kids. And this is a way of saying to people who, when they say they have fears about it, like, oh, we're doing something about it, we're going to do these age assessments, it's going to be fine. So a lot of this is a kind of media forward policy, which is not necessarily done for anyone's good, apart from placating a right-wing press that has got obsessed about this issue.
And what was it like for when Ukrainians were coming? I mean, there's 176,000 Ukrainians came within a heartbeat, and all of them received supports and seemingly no problems there. It's actually double the number of others who are coming through the small boats. So what does that double standard look like on the ground?
I mean, I think it looks like, to be honest, what it's looked like in many European countries in that sense of allowing borders to be porous, to be open for Ukrainians, because, quite frankly, they're white and European looking, whatever this notion we have. And so the kind of racism has come into play a huge amount with, I would argue, with this, not just in the UK, but we had this Homes for Ukraine where people could sponsor to have Ukrainians in their homes and host them. Ukrainians could apply for a visa, which lasted for 2 years, I think, so around that.
What kind of visa?
It was like a sort of permission to stay kind of visa. They were allowed to stay, work, go to school or whatever, and then they can extend it for 18 months or whatever. Now, it was lasting for 2 years up until now, and then I think they've got a new thing to replace it. There are fears right now, to be honest, about what's going to happen with that moving forward, whether there's going to be a tightening of that. What happens when this extension period, which lasts for 18 months after this, after May 2024, I think people get another 18 months. So it's not, to be frank, it's not like the Ukrainians have been given, a leave to remain forever. And it's not like ideal either, but obviously it's a world away from what other people are experiencing, and they're obviously treated very differently. And there's a reason no Ukrainians were taking small boats across the channel, because they had a legal route to the UK, which of course, we saw across Europe as well. And that was a very clear distinction. But again, it's not the perfect situation for Ukrainians either, but it is completely different. I mean, their rights, they're not they don't experience the same things other people have experienced when they've come as refugees to the UK. They would argue that they had a very difficult time, and they, of course they did, but they had a much easier time comparatively to what other people have had. And yeah, it was legal to host them in your home. You could sponsor to have people living with you. It was a completely different vision of, you know, accommodating refugees.
Did they have the option to apply for asylum?
I think under the current, this is a very specific Ukrainian route, right? So I don't know actually if there's people who have applied for asylum, but I think they've probably all done this route because it was very instantaneous and you could stay there in the UK. I mean, I'm sure they could apply for asylum, but it would have been a way more difficult thing, I think, than what they've currently had right now. I'm actually not sure if they've applied for asylum, but this route was made specifically for Ukrainians, so they probably would have been directed to this route.
Yeah, there's this famous, press conference that's happening with Braverman as the Home Secretary at the time, being grilled by, I'm assuming, a Labour Party representative, asking, if I'm a 16-year-old from some African country, what's my pathway to asylum procedure in the UK? And then they just can't answer it, and they can't get around. Well,
yeah, I remember that.
You know, it's just like this, like, and then she's referencing and talking off camera, off mic to her lawyers and the other people on her border, and no one could give a clear answer. So it just seems very clear that there is not a legal pathway for people unless they are from specific countries.
Yeah. I mean, there's been at times there was a route for Syrians at one point, but you had to be taken directly from Syria. So, there are no legal routes, essentially. I mean, that's what people have been arguing. And there was an amazing campaigner called Lord Alf Dubs, who himself was a child refugee to the UK. He came on the Kinder transport, so he was amongst all the Jewish children saved on a transport which evacuated them to the UK. And he's campaigned a lot for child refugees to be brought from the camps in Calais, you know, unaccompanied child refugees. And that he had briefly some success with that, but it was shut down, that scheme, very quickly or limited. And, it, you know, even the ones that temporarily open are only marginal, you know. There are essentially no legal routes, you know. The government might argue that, wait your turn, you know, wait in wherever you're from that you're trying to flee, wait, and, you know, obviously that's not a reasonable thing to ask people. I mean, you're a refugee for a reason. That press conference, I remember it, but that just illustrates this kind of crazy mirror world that we're living in, because there are no legal routes essentially to come. So people come in the channel, and then it's just this cat and mouse game, it seems, continually and not addressing the real issue, which is, how do we create ways for people to come which are safe and which are accessible? But I fear that no politician's going to fully address something like that, because quite frankly, they fear the right-wing press. Sorry, I've deviated, I know, from the original question.
No, that's fine. Yeah. But I think it also kind of comes into the heart of the issue, in that there is a double standard. There's this really powerful, heavy film called The Green Border that just came out recently from Poland. And it's about how people who were trying to cross the forest between Belarus and Poland had been ping-ponged back and forth and left to die in the forest. And then weeks, months, and now it's continued later, you have Ukrainians' wide open border. And the film is really powerful to show this double standard. But it feels like the same thing's happening in the UK, because the number, if you really do the math of it, it's like 0.001% of the people coming into the country are coming from these small boats, and yet that seems like an outsized storyline versus net migration into the UK, where you're over 1 million people and almost none of them are coming from EU countries.
Yeah.
And yeah. We were talking earlier about like the workforce that, yeah. I mean, that they're actually brought in to work for 20% less than a native UK worker, and it's all in the care industry. So it's interesting to me to think about the irony of maybe it's like in American politics, it's traditional that older voters tend to be a bit more conservative in their votes. I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but they may be the ones who are voting against outsiders coming in, and yet those are the ones who are the caregivers.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's, I think that's true. I mean, the Brexit vote was predominantly voted for by the older generation, you know, to leave. And there were, of course, young people that voted for it. But yeah, it was by and large the older generation. But all of this is a deflection from what's happening in our kind of country, which is, I mean, okay, things have definitely, from my point of view, got worse since Brexit. We've struggled to find people even to work in the service industry, to do things like agricultural work in the fields, picking fruit, in the health service. The sort of, everyone loves to talk about the NHS because it's a very popular, people feel very attached to our health service because it's free, and it's kind of this iconic part of being British is having free healthcare. But that's really suffered because of Brexit, but quite frankly, all of this talking about migration, small boats, even net migration, whatever, we have such bigger issues happening. You know, we have huge levels of child poverty. We have, again, the health service, which is struggling like it's never struggled before because of a lack of investment. So many different issues, which, you know, people, record levels of people using food banks. I mean, baby banks, like, you know, where people are going to get things for their babies. I mean, it's unbelievable. And yet what we focus on is migration. And it's this stop the small boats. And people are struggling in the UK, really struggling. I mean, it's really, it's not a good situation for so many people in the UK. And yet this obsession it becomes with the small boats, with talking about it, it's so infuriating. And personally, yeah, it's really upsetting, actually. But yeah, this is the way things are now, especially since Brexit feels like a backward slide in many ways. Sorry, a small rant there about Brexit and everything, but yeah.
No, it's all, it's all intertwined.
We'll have you next year.
You've exhausted Rashid's.
What, 3rd of April, 2025?
2025 it is, hopefully. Okay.
Don't schedule anything on that.
I'll be sure to.
No, we want you back sooner so we can talk about all the stuff we just discussed, only about Greece.
Perfect, yes. Yeah. Right? Great.
There's so much to unpack here.
Yeah, things are so good here as well, so, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for joining us and always being a supporter. And I just also wanted to just say thank you for being the type of journalist who does it the right way, in that you have always made space for people like on our crew here. In the work you did on Lesbos, you were constantly selfless in engaging and sharing bylines and bringing people from our community who were practicing journalism. You were bringing them into the process. You were utilizing your advantages as an established journalist to provide them a chance to get started. And without that, many of them would not have profiles on Al Jazeera or The Guardian. So thank you for the type of collaboration that we're hoping to develop with all sorts of journalists who come through to do this work. So it's really, really wonderful to see that how genuinely this came from you all the time, consistently.
Oh,
so
we're thanks,
very
Daddy.
Deeply indebted to you.
I appreciate the work you guys are all doing. And yeah, I'm just very grateful that I can come back and speak to you guys. And it seems to just grow and get better every time. So yeah, no, I appreciate you guys too. Thank you very much again.
Wonderful. Well, I'd like to thank everyone from our team, Davoud, Ellie, Sude, Rashid, Sonia from Poland, myself, Douglas, and everyone else that supports our podcast. It's wonderful to have the lights here that were illuminated by Aperture. We would love for you to continue to support us and provide more. And if there are any other organizations or media industry partners out there that would love to join forces with us, please do so. Reach out to us. We unpacked a lot of information today, and we only scratched the surface, to be honest. So we're going to put a lot of stuff in the show notes. We would love to have Katie back and go a little deeper into other aspects that we didn't get a chance to cover today. But again, please follow us on Patreon, on social media. You our can website. Go to our website, refocusmedialabs.org.
A lot of cool stuff there. Yeah. Designs by
amazing designs by Ellie and many of our other graphic design programs. Thanks very much to Pollination UK for the work they're doing and collaborating with us, as well as Safe Passage. So we look forward to our next episode with you. And again, if you have any suggestions or things that you would like to include as a topic, please reach out to us, get in touch with us on social media, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. You know, the Fat Tuesday for Mardi Gras? You know, it's like the last day you can eat before the big party.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's the last day. And then you're supposed to, it's Lent, and you're supposed to be all serious. In Poland, they do it on a Thursday, and they call it Fat Thursday, or whatever they call it there. I forget the Polish word for it. But everyone just has to eat as many donuts as they can.
Oh, wow.
And when we did this, Rashid put a chocolate cake inside a donut.
Because
and had two of them.
There was nothing inside the donut.
There was jelly. There was
jelly, but it's not enough. I needed chocolate. I needed chocolate. And there was like a piece of cake, chocolate cake. So I was like, okay, I'm going to make a sandwich here. It was amazing. But I got dizzy after that. I ate it. And I was like, oh, shit. What did I do?